Monday night edition of the Dunk Time Basketball Podcast. We are looking at an action-packed podcast for you tonight. Game 4 of Toronto and Cleveland. Toronto unexpectedly tying the series at 2 up after looking about as bad as you possibly can over the first two games. We'll have a deep dive on that one. Also, we'll talk about the Draymond Green non-suspension, including a little rant by yours truly on what it says for our society that we want guys like him to be suspended so badly. And then we're going to get into more of our off-season cap preview series with shameless pandering to the big markets, the New York Knicks and Los Angeles Clippers. What are the Knicks going to do with their about $28 million in cap space? Can they find a home for Carmelo Anthony that he would actually want to go to with his no-trade clause? And then the Clippers, what could they potentially do, even though they're looking relatively capped out, but they have some free agents to re-sign, and of course the big three as well. Could any of them be traded? And joining me for all of that from our hotel room here in scenic Oklahoma City, Danny LaRue.
That was a shockingly fun game. I was very impressed by it. And the Raptors did a nice job. To me, the game was really won in the first half.
Yeah, I told you this was going to be a fun offensive series. And we saw the potential for that in the first quarter of game one and two before the Raptors just started getting completely blown out. And I thought that one thing that was key, you know, it was 57-41 at halftime. The Cavs put up 41 three-pointers in this game, but they only made 13, which is a far cry from what they were doing against Atlanta. And we saw in the first two games, especially game one, they were so spooked by that three-point shooting that they were just letting the Cavs get whatever they wanted at the rim. And especially in the first half, the Cavs, again, were not able to get to the rim and couldn't make up for it by making threes.
Yeah, not at all. The Cavs only got into the paint, only shot 10 shots in the paint. All of them were from the restricted area. So that means they weren't even getting in there to take those shots. And I think that was about a quarter of their attempts in the entire first half.
The shooting that they had in the Atlanta series and to a lesser extent the Detroit series was never going to sustain it. In fact, Amin Alhassan did a great video on that a bit ago using some of the new sport view data that ESPN has started incorporating, where they basically look at what percentage chance a shot has of going in for a given player with a given level of contest, so you can really start to quantify shot quality a little bit better. And everyone was shooting like 20% above from three what they would have been expected. J.R. Smith and Kyrie Irving above them. Channing Frye remains absolutely on fire, but the other guys have come back to earth a little bit. Smith, for example, was 3-for-11 tonight. So I think the Raps going back to their normal defense has helped. And then, of course, Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan being absolutely on fire doesn't hurt either.
Yeah, Lowry had 20 points in the first half on just 11 shots. He was 8 of 11 from the field, 4 of 6 from 3, and that just continued into the second half.
Yeah, and of course, ever since I said that Kyle Lowry, I was going to just assume that he wasn't going to be the same player in the postseason. He's had two awesome games, but they really highlighted as DeRozan and Lowry went 28 for 43 combined. They've highlighted that this Cleveland defense just isn't that good. And when the threes are not falling, when they are not this absolute offensive juggernaut like they were for the first 10 games of the playoffs, this team can be made to look very ordinary.
And the decisions that Cleveland has to make, because they have big men that are talented but flawed, manifest themselves in the decision that they have to make with Channing Frye. So early in the game, Biombo was doing a great job protecting the rim. They have Tristan Thompson in the game, so Toronto can just put Biombo on him, and so he can stay in the lane the whole time. Cleveland reacted to that by putting in Channing Frye, who Biombo has massive trouble guarding, and I'm sure we can talk about that in some substance. But that has a very real trade-off on the other end, because Frye is maybe his defensive flaws are overly criticized, but he's still certainly not at the level as a help defender and a rim protector of what you would expect for a competent defense.
Yeah, and they don't really have anyone now that Mozgov is out of the rotation who you look at as someone who can protect the rim. And the Raps now have begun to really settle in, get to the basket. The other problem, too, is that the Cavs don't really have a great matchup for DeRozan. He is too big and can get to his spots and rise up over guys like Smith and even Shumpert. And then they put LeBron on him, which I'd been advocating for larger portions of this game. And the Raps had the right strategy. They ran DeRozan through more screens off the ball. Now, I think LeBron did not navigate those well. I think that his level of discipline has really kind of waned now that he doesn't really guard primary options anymore. And so we saw him try to shoot the gap and miss a few times. We saw him just get picked off a few times. I think that he, you know, could be a little more conservative and not try to do those things and just say, all right, DeRozan, if you want to hit a fadeaway coming off a screen, go for it. But I thought the Raps did a nice job. And then they also ran some screens means to get LeBron off of DeRozan, because if it's just a straight ISO, DeRozan has no chance on LeBron. But they attacked him in the way that he is weaker, in a way that impressed me. I didn't think that's something they would necessarily do.
They did a nice job with that, but they were also helped by the fact that LeBron played 45 minutes in this game, and I think he played the entire second half. And
yes, he did.
It's incredibly hard to shoulder the offensive load that he does. He did a magnificent job passing in this game, and then also take on not the hardest defensive assignment for when you're facing the Raptors, but close to it.
Yeah, and that just, maybe in his younger days he might have done that, but even for that number of minutes would have been crazy. I think it made sense for Lou to go for it, because you win this game and the series is probably over next game. You know, game four is so pivotal, just as we're about to see in the Golden State Oklahoma City series, where there's just such a difference between 2-2 and 3-1. You might as well just go for it if you think you can get the series over, but they weren't able to do that. The Raptors overall have just continued shooting very well from mid-range. I don't know that that can continue at quite this level, even though there is a difference in the quality of defense from the Cavs versus Miami or the Pacers, where those shots, yeah, they're technically contested, but DeRozan is comfortable. He knows he's not going to get his shot blocked. He's not going to get bumped off his spot by whoever's guarding him, unless it's LeBron. Lowry has got Kyrie on him the whole time. You know, he's just not going to get through a screen. He knows his jumper is going to be open. He was 4 out of 7 on threes. And then they shot pretty well at the rim, too. It really just all over the place, they shot it pretty well. And it's kind of tough for Lou because he doesn't have that much in the way of two-way players, right? You could say, all right, we're going to go to Shumpert more, but Smith has been on fire. I always thought they were going to need Shumpert, who was such a stalwart for them last year defensively, but has not really been able to get it going on offense. So Lou's kind of in that same boat now as the Thunder always seemed to be until recently, where he's got the offensive options, he's got the defensive options, but he doesn't necessarily have guys who can do it both ways.
One of the surprising kind of holes that Lou dug himself in this game is that one of the few constants that Cleveland has had in this playoffs is that unit that starts the second and fourth quarters that had done so well. And in the second quarter, they went away from that and went with a different substitution strategy and struggle. That was part of what led to the Toronto run. And largely that same group ended up almost bringing them back in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, because I think they did. That was the one rest that LeBron had, was at the start of the second. I think he played like the first 14 minutes of the game or so. And yeah, that lineup with Dellavedova at the one, Shumpert or J.R. Smith, Jefferson, LeBron at the four, Fry at the five is something that is really difficult to deal with. And we'll talk in greater depth about the fourth quarter in a moment. Let's talk a little bit more, though, about Kevin Love. Did not play again in the fourth quarter for the second straight game. Appeared to tweak his ankle when stepping on the referee at the end of the third. Lou had some somewhat interesting quotes about him, though, huh?
He did. He said, so the Cavs obviously went on that run at the beginning of the fourth quarter, and Lou said that he had considered bringing Love in late, so like I think it was about 4 minutes left, and said that it would be unfair to him to bring him back so late in a game in a hostile environment. And Kevin Love is a max player. I mean, you can't think that way with somebody like him, especially when the other options, the guy who was playing over him particularly was Richard Jefferson, who had done well, but is not Kevin Love.
Well, I don't know. Maybe you should think that way about him, because it's starting to get pretty ugly for him in these playoffs. Other than his three-point shooting, which admittedly is excellent, he is providing very, very little. And he is now shooting 8 out of 30 in the restricted area for the playoffs. That's 27% for the math uninclined. In the paint, non-restricted area, 42%, which is okay. It's about league average. From mid-range, which is a lot of his post-ups, he is a putrid 10 out of 37, and then is shooting quite well on three-pointers. But if it weren't for his three-pointers, he really would be a non-threat. And if all he's going to do is hit threes, you might as well just put Fry out there at that point, because he's going to actually is a better shooter than Love is as a quicker release, probably a little bit more accurate, and maybe even not quite as big of a liability defensively, although neither of them are great shakes. You could argue that a little bit. But so I don't know. And considering how the unit that they had out there was coming back so well, I don't think that it necessarily was the wrong decision to leave him out. But and you could even question, although probably not because he's been even better than Love has in these playoffs, whether bringing Kyrie back in was the right decision because their ball movement began to stagnate basically as soon as he returned.
There's definitely a different dynamic on the floor when it's Love and Dellavedova as the real ball handlers, and I think we saw that at the beginning of the fourth quarter, and Kyrie, as talented as he is, definitely adds a feel to that team, and he needs his touches because he's that good. And at certain moments, simplification can work. And why it was remarkable in this was that Toronto just couldn't stop it when Cleveland was running basically the same play for the entire start of that fourth.
Yeah, they scored through the end of the third and the beginning of the fourth on 10 straight possessions to the tune of 23 points. When they weren't in transition, it was basically the same play. They would throw the ball to LeBron at the right elbow, pretty deep position too, which is important because he's got a short pass then to hit Jefferson, who would receive a back screen from Dellavedova. Dellavedova does a great job of screening, and he opened up Jefferson a couple of times on the back door, and then if that didn't work, they either switched it or Dellavedova's man would be behind him because he helped on Jefferson going back door. Then Dellavedova would go get a dribble handoff from LeBron, and they would have Fry in the opposite corner. So Biombo would feel uncomfortable helping off of Fry, and when you're doing that dribble handoff, you're basically turning that into a pick and roll. LeBron would immediately roll to the hoop. They got an alley-oop there when the guy guarding LeBron, which was Patterson, stepped up too far on Dellavedova, which every team always seems to get sucked into, despite the fact that a Dellavedova 2 is the shot that you want. Deli did hit a tough floater. They defended that better. They hit Fry on the backside for threes a couple of times when Biombo sucked in too much. It was really just, we could say every possible way that you could get beat on that play, they got beat. And I think maybe for the 11th time in a row that they ran it, they finally stopped it. And I think all of basketball Twitter gave a sarcastic cheer at that point.
And then Cleveland started going away from it. I don't think it was because it got stopped once, but it just happened to coincide.
Yeah, I don't know how much they went away from it. Lou actually got asked about that, and he said he was trying to run some things for, to get some other kind of DHO actions going. And in fact, I think the play where we can pick it up with, where Lowry just came up from behind on LeBron, they were trying to run similar action, Lou said in the post game. Lowry just fouled the crap out of LeBron on that play. I can't believe there was no call. Like, he was a good 2 feet away from actually hitting the ball. It was just right on in like the crook of LeBron's elbow, basically. And then Lowry got a foul. That put them up on the fast break. Did a great job to do that, by the way, because you and I, as soon as that steal happened, I was like, oh, this is getting blocked by LeBron. And Lowry did a great job to just slow down, get into LeBron's path, and pick up the foul, hitting one out of two. And that, with a little under 3 minutes left, put Toronto ahead by four. And that was the beginning of a run that was definitely like sphincter tightening time for Toronto. But amazingly, they managed to get through it even after giving up that huge 17-point lead.
Yeah, I sometimes use the phrase dodging raindrops for a situation like what happened here, because what happened on the next play was that the Cavs got two wide open threes. First one was to Dellavedova, then they got an offensive rebound, got out to Channing Frye, and missed both of them, but both of them were clean looks. So you can kind of attribute that to whatever you want, but you know, the game at that point should have probably been a one-point game.
Yeah, when you get two threes from 40% three-point shooters, you would expect to make one. And this was, they did go away from that same look at that point because it was all 1-3 pick and roll and then get the switch and throw it to LeBron. They did that three possessions in a row, and they put Lowry on LeBron. Toronto, there wasn't really even much of a screen. Toronto was relatively comfortable switching that. I thought Lowry did a pretty good job. He's just got that low center of gravity. In some respects, he's actually better against LeBron because LeBron's not going to be able to just, like, you know, out-quick him, and he didn't have to lean on him as hard. He's just got, you know, really great core strength, even though he lost all that weight at the start of the year. And then eventually they had to bring a double. And so when Dellavedova and Fry missed those threes, then the next two possessions, they did the same thing. And Biombo had two amazing closeouts. One was to Kyrie, and then Kyrie just hit a 28-footer right in his face with the shot clock going down, but that was great defense. And then the possession after that, they threw it to Fry, DeRozan rotated to him, and then Biombo got out on DeRozan's man, J.R. Smith, and then actually blocked Smith's three-pointer after Smith unsuccessfully tried to beat him off the dribble. That just shows you the defensive versatility of Biombo. I mean, I think defensively, you know, talking about his upcoming free agency, he's like a 9 to 9.5 out of 10 on defense. His intelligence is not quite there sometimes, but he's just so fast and long and able to switch and strong, and then he's a great defensive rebounder that he makes up for, you know, not being the absolute most intelligent guy just with his effort and his activity level.
He played extremely well in this game and illustrated the value, which you and I have both talked about forever, of having a rim protector, because they affect the shots that a team takes. As we said, Cleveland only took 10 shots in the entire paint the whole time, the painted areas, Hubie would say, and in the whole first half.
I just saw him upstairs in the lounge of the hotel, actually. I didn't have a chance to say hi, though, because I was on the phone. But yeah, we are recording this podcast, you know, within probably 100 feet of Iran at this very moment.
That is incredibly exciting. And and also, I wanted to note, while we're praising Biombo, that there was that a really interesting moment in the midst of all these defensive possessions where, after the Fry missed three, Biombo got the defensive rebound, and the Cavs, before he moved the ball, committed an intentional foul on him, which I think is a great decision.
Yeah, you know, I wonder whether that was actually called. You know, he shoots, I think, you know, mid-50s. I don't recall exactly. Enough that where if you're down four with 2 minutes left and you can foul him and get one out of two with no time going off the clock, that's probably the right play. I don't know whether Delly was just going for the steal kind of out of frustration or whether that was something that they'd been told to do. But that's something that teams really should do more in those situations, is make sure you foul the other team. Great defensive rebounding, but poor free throw shooting center. But unfortunately for the Cavs, they just couldn't get a defensive rebound of their own in the last 2 minutes. They gave up one to DeRozan or to Patterson after DeRozan missed a really tough shot in the baseline, and then DeRozan had just an unbelievable finish with about a minute 30 left in the game off of Patterson, who got just a totally uncontested rebound. And then Biombo, just a monster rebound after Lowry missed it with almost no time left on the shot clock, just pushed Fry under, was able to get the tip out, and then Lowry scored the icing bucket with about 30 seconds left. Maybe about 20 seconds left. That was another time after a timeout, after the offensive rebound, where they could have fouled, where they could have trapped, because they're about, you know, they're clearly going to try to run the time down. So you might as well trap, see if you can get a turnover then. But they didn't do that. And then Lowry just blew by J.R. Smith. Biombo held Thompson on the near side, so he couldn't get into the play. But for Thompson, you just have to play with more force than that, right? Like, if he's holding you, you at least have to move hard enough that, like, you get pulled back and it's obvious to the ref that you are being held. You know, he didn't move, even try to move. He just sort of, like, then went and complained to the ref afterwards. But if you're not, like, you have to create some sort of force to where you're being held back and the ref will make that call. And that Lowry layup, completely uncontested, ended the game.
Yeah, it was a huge play. And as you brought up, people were talking about, oh, you know, Tristan was held and all that, but you can draw that call in today's NBA if you make it obvious enough. And if you're just standing there, then they're not going to give you the benefit of the doubt as often as maybe they should.
So a few little things on this one. Number one, Jonas Valanciunas was actually active and did not play at all. And I cautioned at the beginning of the game that if he was going to come off the bench, which made sense with how Biombo had been playing and the fact that I think things are just kind of ginger for him, that it was going to be tough for him if he's going to match up with Fry. Like, he wasn't going to be 100% healthy, so just going into the post on Fry, who's actually not that bad of a post defender either, and then having Valanciunas try to get out on Fry, I mean, that's part of the problem. They should probably put their center on, like, Richard Jefferson in that lineup. Still not a great option because he's also a good three-point shooter, but not the threat that Fry is. And so Casey just didn't play him. And I thought that was, things were going so well. Maybe it was sort of like, all right, if we really get down here, we can go to Jonas and see if he can give us a boost. So I thought that was great. It'll be something to monitor, though, of when is Casey going to go to him. Presumably he'll get more healthy between now and Wednesday. And I think probably what I would try to do is bring him in just only when Thompson is on the floor, maybe play him in like two short stints, like kind of middle of the first, middle of the second, and same thing in the third and fourth to get some more offense on the floor, some offensive rebounding. But I also think with the Cavs' three-point shooting, you know, this may not necessarily be the series for him. They struggle enough to stop him when Biombo's out there, and he's, you know, about as much of a specimen as you could hope for on defense.
It's challenging with Valanciunas because, the situations that you want to use him are also the times that Biombo is thriving the most. And so are you willing to sacrifice what he gives them defensively, especially if those times have Lowry and DeRozan on the floor who are carrying the offense? So it's certainly a challenge. One thing that is less of a challenge for Dwayne Casey is excising Luis Scola, or at least heavily modifying his role, who, despite playing the beginning of the first and third, with the beginning of the first being one of the most successful stretches for the Raptors, Scola was still minus two in 14 minutes in this game.
Yeah, when they started coming back on in the third quarter, he was out there, and he just doesn't really give them much. I think that, if there's like a sports bar in hell, it would just consist of like Scola and Vereshchuk trading off, getting dumb reach and fouls over and over, of which Scola had a couple in this game, chasing after offensive rebounds that they can't get and trying to hound whoever the guard is afterwards. And then, of course, flopping on a call that they have no chance of getting and giving up an offensive rebound. Like, both of those guys, it's amazing how that appears to be in both of their DNA, which is too bad, because when those guys weren't in their mid-30s, they were actually pretty good players. But now they're at the point where they just don't offer much, and the refs are not rewarding those sort of tricks of the trade as much as they used to. I think, you know, reacting to what you were saying earlier about Valanciunas, if you're having trouble scoring, then you go to Valanciunas. But their defense has been the bigger problem in the series. Lowry and DeRozan, with the way they're going, there's really no reason that you need more offense. They've been killing the Cavs offensively the last couple of games. If they're struggling to score in game five, then yeah, maybe I would go to Valanciunas some. And, you know, he might be a better option at times than playing James Johnson, who really struggled in this one. Again, he just is so spacey on defense. He loses shooters. He just makes terrible decisions. Like on one play, he just couldn't get matched up in transition, lost Channing Frye. He'll help when there's just no need to. Like, there was a time when Richard Jefferson was trying to drive past Patterson. Jefferson's not going to do anything. He was totally stuck on the baseline, and Johnson just came over to help anyway, gave up a dunk. Like, unless you are using Johnson for, like, a four-minute stretch just to guard LeBron James while Damari Carroll is getting a rest or in foul trouble, there's no reason to have him on the floor. And it's too bad for him, because that lack of awareness defensively is what has made him unplayable, even for a Raptors team that historically has been desperate for the sort of one-on-one defense he can provide on the wing against bigger forwards.
It's always frustrating for me when a player has the physical tools to be a very good defender, especially somebody like Johnson, who has the physical tools to be a defender on those power threes, which are such a bear for almost anybody else to handle, but because of a lack of awareness or effort or whatever it is for that specific guy, just can't do it. And James Johnson has definitely fallen into that group in the last couple of years.
DeRozan, again, we noted it in game three, it continued tonight, just doing a better job of hustling in the floor game, not getting completely killed defensively, getting some rebounds, and just not sort of playing like a fraidy cat the way he has for most of these playoffs, sticking his nose in there. And that really makes a difference. Maybe that's some of the confidence that he gets from the crowd exhorting him on. And then the last thing too, we said yesterday, it was yesterday, that one thing that the Cavs did was bringing Biombo in early to foil those LeBron post-ups. They tried that once early on, and the Cavs' adjustment was to just run a snug pick and roll with J.R. Smith, and then they actually threw the ball to Smith afterwards, and he hit a three, although Biombo did a pretty good job of getting out on him. But mostly it was just Carroll still guarding LeBron, and Biombo did an amazing job of 2.9ing. And one of the things he did, we talked about this last year when LeBron would go to these ISO post-ups, is you got to either stay on the weak side and just be ready to come over when LeBron starts his move for real, or you need to get all the way over to the strong side right away. What you can't do is just come into the lane as soon as he catches the ball, then, oh no, it's 3 seconds is coming, I got to get out. And then as soon as you go to get out, that's when he starts his move and blows by you. Like, so you got to either be on one side or the other and be in a position where you can react, instead of, you never want to be in the situation where you're actually moving away from LeBron, because that's when he'll start his move and just kill you.
Going back to your first point of that, DeRozan also deserves credit for fighting harder for opportunity shot opportunities in the fourth quarter. He was 5 of 6, and only 2 of those 6 were what I would classify as long twos, and they were better looks in general than he has been settling for throughout this. And he also had 2 free throws, deserves some credit for that.
Hey, so what did you make for your first Blue Apron meal?
My first meal was a chicken, Middle Eastern chicken and chickpea stew. It turned out really well.
Yeah, mine was a salmon with peas and arugula salad. The thing that I've been most impressed by so far is the quality of the produce. I have always just passionately hated peas and got them, and I really enjoyed them, really for the first time, because they were just so incredibly fresh. So for those who don't know what Blue Apron is, they ship you portioned out ingredients that are extremely fresh. They are shipped refrigerated. You get your week's meals sent to you waiting at your door. And You can cook them anywhere from like about 20 to 40 minutes or so to make them. There's no food waste whatsoever because everything is portioned out for you. And they just provide you with the recipes and you can just cook it all at home, basically be a gourmet chef at home without all of the drama of having to go to the supermarket. It just shows up right at your door. I thought it was awesome. So your dad's a gourmet cook. Did he like it?
He really did. And the most impressive meal so far was we did seared pork chops with a spinach dish and then a mashed potato dish. And yeah, I grew up in a house with two parents that are very talented chefs, and they both absolutely loved it. It's a different experience, but something that created a quality meal. And I did almost all of the cooking, and that was a great experience as well.
Yeah, my girlfriend and I like it a lot too. We are actually cooking together again, which we are now prioritizing because we have these meals. That's another great thing about it is you really want to cook. We can't do it at night because I'm watching games. We've been doing it during the day for lunch, and it's been fantastic. It's really healthy as well, perfectly balanced meals. The portion sizes are enough to fill you up, but not so much that you're really overeating. I think it's been awesome. So you can check out this week's menu and get two meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/capspace. You remember capspace, all one word. That's the tag we use for all these. This one is a URL. Make sure you go to that blueapron.com/capspace so you know they came from us. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. blueapron.com/capspace. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. All right, now that I've made us both hungry, let's... this is not a good segue, but let's move on to Draymond not being suspended. I said yesterday I thought that it was the right call. A lot of Law and Order hardcore types are bemoaning the fact that Draymond was not suspended, and I think this is another one that Adam Silver's NBA should be lauded for. They continue in these suspension situations, Isaiah Thomas being another one, that when intent is not entirely clear, they give players the benefit of the doubt. And that's the way it should be. You know, it's one thing if it's Dante Jones coming in and just for the end of the game and then with a closed fist hitting someone below the belt. That's completely different from what this was from Draymond. He, and as Kiki Vandeweghe noted in a good interview with Sam Amick of USA Today, this was a totally different play. And another thing that was a ridiculous argument was this idea that, oh, he did it for the second game in a row. As Kiki noted, that was purely accidental. There's no way you're going to do a Euro step, try to drive to the basket, make a shot, and oh yeah, why don't I divide my attention from making the shot to also knee this guy below the belt? Like, that's just something that is not true. That was clearly an accident. It wasn't a reckless play. It's impossible to jump off of 1 foot without raising your other knee. So I thought they reached the right decision here, and I'm glad that he will be playing in game four. And now the Warriors just have to figure out, you know, how to actually fix everything that really went wrong in the game last night.
It is a little bit of a shame that this incident has diverted some of the focus from what was a spectacular effort by the Thunder and a magnificently flawed game from the Warriors, you know, in the second and third quarters. But I think the league, like you do, I think the league came to the right decision. Listeners should definitely read Vandeweghe's interview with Amick. I think beyond the use of the word fact pattern like four times, which was amusing to me, I think there's a maturity to the way that they're handling this. And I think that the intent part of this matters, and you're trying to do a lot of different things with punishments, and the league is aware of the fact that suspending somebody is a very severe action. It is an action that is certainly warranted in circumstances, especially those that are strong intentional fouls or things that you want to dissuade. But the Draymond play, it toes a couple of different lines, because it would be great if the league didn't facilitate and didn't encourage the kind of flopping and exaggerated contact that it has, but this isn't the right time or the right place to combat that.
This is kind of something that I think I don't particularly care for in our society overall, is this idea that, well, we used to do it really badly, so we had to deal with it, so now we should just continue doing it that way in the future, right? Like, oh, well, and all these people are like, oh, well, all of these plays in the past, you know, there was precedent, and number one, all those people were wrong. Like, this fell very far at the low end of the scale of, like, the various below-the-belt plays that we have had suspensions for or not had suspensions for. This is definitely at the lower end of that scale, so anyone who was saying, oh, it's the same thing as Dante Jones, that was ridiculous. But, and then to say also, oh, they've been so harsh, they followed the letter of the law, you know, the Suns, I mean, the most hilarious thing is the fan bases that have suffered the most from these, like, you know, Memphis, for example, with Zach Randolph, who just straight up punched Steven Adams. Like, yeah, when you punch someone in the face with a closed fist, there's no plausible deniability there. That's what you meant to do. So you probably should get suspended for that one. Like, that's pretty obvious. You know, Draymond had some plausible deniability. Maybe you could even say it was a reckless play if you wanted to. I think even that is somewhat dubious. But to say that, you know, that's the same as Zach Randolph punching someone or... And so now we have this thing in our society where it wasn't done well before, right? This is like, this is why every fraternity, the hazing is miserable, right? It's like, oh, I had to go through this terrible thing. So now everybody who comes into the fraternity has to do that. Or doctors, hey, I had to work these crazy 100-hour weeks when I was a resident. So yeah, even though this is going to lead to exhausted people caring for patients, well, I had to go through it, so now they have to go through it too. You know, that's kind of like how these fan bases think now. And I'm just glad he's going to play. I want to watch basketball. I want to watch basketball at the highest level. And if there's any question whatsoever about it, let the guy play. And the league, kudos to them for making the right decision. And Vandeweghe and I were on exactly the same wavelength as far as what he said in that interview.
And while I'm not sure it should be a consideration, because I think it should be a case-by-case basis with, of course, prior history mattering, the fact that Draymond is now on the razor's edge in terms of flagrant foul, a suspension for flagrant fouls.
Right, because it was upgraded to a flagrant 2 and he was fined $25,000.
So I think that it does make it easier in that sense that, you know, with a flagrant 1, he'll be suspended for a single game. And if he got a flagrant 2, I believe he would be ejected from that game and suspended for 2 more. So I think that's the way that works if you get
and suspended for 2 more. No, he'd be suspended the next
one. Okay, well, anyway, it's still a substantial penalty. So he's on that, and then he's a couple technicals away. I think he's at 4 and 7 is the first punishment. So Draymond Green, the heartbeat of the Warriors, will definitely have to take all of that into account, and it should affect the way that he plays. But they reached the right outcome, and I agree with your entire... I don't want to call it a tirade because I don't want to diminish it. I agree with it entirely. But
I don't know. We could say it was a tirade.
Like, for me, as a larger overall point, I feel like the argument of something being the status quo, especially when it's a negative, but in any circumstance, is not the justification for continuing it if you can come to something that is a more reasonable, equitable, and sustainable solution.
So now the stakes are set for this incredible game 4 that we're going to be at tomorrow night. I still don't know how much to make of this. I actually went on a podcast with Anthony Slater from the Oklahoman today, which I recommend you guys listen to. We talked a lot about this series and the Thunder, if you're interested in that. Also, actually went on the True Hoop TV to talk a lot about this this Draymond thing, which is we made some of the same points, but that was before the verdict actually came out, but hit on a bunch of other subjects as well there with a cast of people more famous than myself. But this game could be the series, right? Because 2-2 going back home, Golden State's got to be the favorite. If the Thunder win 3-1, it's probably over for Golden State. So this game is going to be all of it. I just still don't know what to make of the fact that Oklahoma City beat the Warriors so badly, but I still stick by the idea that Stephen Curry is just going to have to be the best player on the floor, and if he's not, the Warriors will be very hard-pressed to win tomorrow.
There's absolutely a parallel, and I wrote about this in my Game 3 analysis for The Athletic. There's definitely a parallel between Game 3 in this series and Game 3 in the NBA Finals last year against Cleveland, where the Warriors got outplayed. The final margin got closer, but I think they were down 17.
Yeah, but they at least found something in the fourth quarter.
Right, that's right.
And also, that Cleveland team, just on paper, was so overmatched compared to this Thunder team that you still arguably has more pure talent than the Warriors do.
Thank you for making the point I was about to turn
My
into.
Bad.
But yeah, but that's the idea, is that this, the difference is that you had that positive sign, but the more important thing is that Oklahoma City right now is playing substantially better with meaningfully better talent than Cleveland did. So while that is a parallel, the Warriors need to step it up substantially. While it is not predictive in this sense, it is also still true that the Warriors have not lost consecutive games, and this is not the first time they have looked really bad in the playoffs. They've had a couple of strange performances like that. And, I mean, maybe the weirdest non-back-to-back losses was that game against Portland, Game 4, where they struggled throughout it, but then Stephen Curry saved them with that crazy fourth quarter in overtime, and they might need, as you said, another performance like that to make this a 2-2 series.
So we're going to move on to the Knicks offseason, but first a message from our friends at Vistaprint. I am a small business owner, and that's what this podcast is. And Vistaprint has been excellent for me in my promotion. I was handing out business cards to people just at the game the other day that I was meeting and kind of schmoozing with a little bit. And I got them for just $9.99, 500 business cards, when entering my promo code CAPSPACE at checkout. CAPSPACE, easy to remember. We talk about it all the time on the show. That's what it is for all of our sponsors. And Vistaprint, for with them, business cards are just the tip of the iceberg. They offer tons of custom products for home or office needs, postcards, flyers, banners, apparel, invitations, coffee mugs, anything you want to put a message on, a logo on, they can do it. And Vistaprint absolutely guarantees you'll love whatever you buy from them every time, or they will make it right. They have amazing customer service, just like your local print shop, but they have the economies of scale and the fast turnaround time of the big boys. And they also offer custom design services to help you design the perfect product for your business. If you're kind of struggling with what it should look like, they have even industry specific templates that you can use as well. So the offer is 500 business cards starting at just $9.99. Use that code CAPSPACE at checkout. Make sure you do that so they know that you came from us. You can get up to 50% savings over the regular site pricing using that code, and then they will continue to advertise with us. So go to Vistaprint.com right now, enter that CAPSPACE code, and you'll be very pleased with the service you get. The New York Knicks have yet another interesting offseason. This is not quite the 2010 offseason and what has sort of been promised to Knicks fans, but they do have a fair amount of flexibility now. What are you kind of thinking about? What is like the initial question for you about the overall direction of this Knicks franchise starting with this offseason?
There are two. One is, is this the time that they're going to be able to successfully get off Carmelo Anthony and his remaining contract? And then the second one is, I think this is a major test of their patience, because while there is a chance that they can do some great things in free agency, my feeling is that they would be much more successful waiting until 2017. However, that requires a level of judiciousness that the Knicks have not exhibited when they've had space in the recent past.
Well, I thought that they didn't do too badly last year. You know, I thought that Lopez was, if not a great contract, an appropriate contract. Someone that could be tradable if you needed to. Aflalo and Derek Williams, yeah, they gave them the player options for this year, but they are both likely to opt out of their about $8 million and $5 million salaries, respectively, for next year. Those were their major contracts. Kyle O'Quinn, another guy I thought was a value contract, although he fell out of the rotation a bit as they went along. They spent $2.8 million for 1 year on Serafin. He's now a free agent. So I think Phil has done a decent job of not compromising the future too badly, but they still have this issue that they are not on the same timeline as Carmelo, who will turn 32 during next season. And the problem is, of course, that he has a trade kicker, which could pay him up to $10 million extra if he gets traded next year. The way that works is you take the amount of salary remaining on the contract and you multiply it by the 15%. Earlier in the contract, it wouldn't have mattered because he was at the max salary or so close to it that it wouldn't have been that much. Now he could make almost $10 million extra because the max salary is going to be going up some more if he gets traded this year. So that's a consideration for him on why he might want to get traded. He's made plenty of money in his career, so maybe not. And then he also, of course, has the no trade. And I mean, maybe, I guess, let's look at it first. What should the strategy be? Well, no, actually, this is easier. Do you think that they have a place that they could trade him where they could get something useful back and that he would actually want to go? That's always difficult, right? To trade a veteran somewhere that he'd want to go. Those teams, by their nature, aren't going to have high draft picks, usually aren't going to have great prospects because they've been good already. That's why he wants to go there. So that makes it kind of hard to find him a destination.
It does. I think that realistically, they probably shouldn't be looking for something useful and unloading him. While that would be the ideal, I'm such a big believer in their ability to use cap space, being the New York team, especially considering how...
Well, what is that based on, though?
That's based on the idea that players are interested in going there, and now that they have Porzingis, who is a talented young player who can be better, and I think that they, you know, it is a little bit unfounded.
Yeah, at the best free agent the Knicks have ever signed is, I think, Amari Stoudemire.
At least in the recent past, I
can't. It's not like they had cap space for, you know, a good 15 years there, but nonetheless, they don't have an unbelievable job. I guess Carmelo really wanted to go there. Oh, Tyson Chandler, actually.
Yeah, I was about to say
they signed him free agent, but yeah, Amari was better than him, but yeah, okay.
But anyway, I think that it also depends on what happens with the other major slash glamour markets in the next couple of years. But they also will have the ability with, if depending on how they spend this summer, with like 50 plus million next year. And if they could unload Melo, then you start to get into some real numbers. And then you get to do one of my favorite pitches, which is that you can try to get two guys in the same summer. And I think that that could really work for them, especially if the Lakers spend their money a little bit more aggressively this summer, which I certainly think is a possibility. And maybe they're the only one of those teams that really has that opportunity there. And I think that that's very realistic, especially when you consider that Miami is likely to spend themselves out too. So they could even be the best of a narrower group than some may be expecting.
Yeah, well, Golden State might have money in 2017. I think a lot of teams could have money. Houston, there will be desirable markets. The Bulls also could be another one. But I think you coined this term, the Nene test, for basically, is a contract an asset? Do you need to give up? Do you need to attach an asset to dump him? Or should you expect something in return? Where does the remainder of Carmelo's contract? He's basically at $25 million this year, $26 million 2017-18, and then an ETO for $28 million in 2018-19. Is that a good contract? Is that a bad contract? Is it neutral? What are your thoughts?
I think it's pretty close to neutral for most teams, but it's not the same for everybody. Like, I think it's a greater negative for those teams where cap space and flexibility is more valuable, the Lakers, the Knicks, and would be more interesting to the places that he probably would not accept a trade, a team that maybe has less flexibility. But, you know, like, let's say theoretically, Milwaukee's a bad idea, but just a team that isn't as successful in recruiting free agents and that could use his scoring. Like, there are teams that I think would be thrilled to have him on that contract, and that's why the no trade combination is so devastating, because I think a lot of those places he just wouldn't want to play.
Boston comes to mind immediately, of course. That is the team that has the most assets yet could still be good. They could really, really use his scoring. And if you're trading for him, this year I think he is probably, when you consider some of the other contracts that are going to be handed out, I mean, Nick Batum's going to be making as much as him probably this year, you know. Chandler Parsons will be close. DeRozan will be close. Harrison Barnes could even be close. He's definitely better than all those guys still. So this year especially, I think he's valuable. The next couple of years, as his salary rises and his production will inevitably decline, then maybe not. Although it's even possible he could opt out of that last year too and save you a little bit and try to get one more deal that, you know, for 3 years instead of one, that might be a little more guaranteed money. Boston, do you think he could make them contenders if they basically just take him into cap space, send a couple of draft picks back, maybe a couple of their young guys?
I think that makes them the second best team in the East, but I wouldn't say that puts them in the title picture when you consider how strong some of these teams are looking in the playoffs.
Yeah, although just getting into the conference finals, I mean, the Raptors, we thought they were dead in the water, and now they're tied with the Cavs. They got three games. Who knows what could happen in those three games? I still think the Cavs are massive favorites, obviously, but, you know, and there's something to be said for having a season where you get to the conference finals, even if you're not looking like you are that close to actually winning it. So, I mean, especially depending on what else happens with Boston, yeah, maybe I would consider making that deal if I were them. And I think if I were Carmelo, you're still on the East Coast, you got a pretty decent chance to win. You might consider going there, and the Celtics would still probably have a little bit of space to work with, depending on what happens with Amir Johnson and Jonas Jerebko. Anywhere else that pops out to you as a potential destination for him? I guess Chicago could be another one, but then they wouldn't have any big guys, and they don't really have anyone to trade for him unless you're going to go Derrick Rose, which I, you know, maybe I'd do that if I were the Bulls, but then they would have nothing at point guard either, and still need a big guy, which they could get in free agency. What do you think of that?
I think that it's not the best use of their resources, especially because I don't think he pushes them to really to that title contender level for that year. And that's the same thing. The other team that I've considered before, but is also unrealistic for that same flaw, is Orlando. I think Orlando could really use his offense from that sense, and they have some defensive players around him to make his life easy, which is why Jay Crowder is a big reason why I like Melo and Boston as a fit. But they're not good enough now, and I think that's more than enough to make it a dicey problem.
Yeah, you could say the Lakers could be another one too. You think he would probably want to go there? I mean, he met with them in 2014 free agency, although I don't think the Lakers, even with him, would be that much better to contend. Maybe, though, I mean, they're going to have so much space, maybe they could sign another pretty good free agent, get Carmelo, and, you know, at least get back into the West playoff picture, potentially. They probably wouldn't be able to stop anybody still, but... Houston, another team that'll have the flexibility to maybe add him. They have a few young guys, especially if Dwight Howard doesn't return. That's about all, really, that pops out as me as a place that he would really want to go would waive the no trade clause for. I mean, there are plenty of other teams that could use him, but just don't seem kind of like big lights enough for him.
Yeah, I agree. Let's move on to a guy who I think we both agree fails the Nene test, but is still pivotal to New York's offseason in a way, which is Jose Calderon.
Yeah, what they're looking at in terms of space, and I mean, I think we'll just assume that they keep Carmelo right now and kind of what the plan should be. And I think the plan is, which we of course are going to probably end up advocating for just about every team, given how thin the market is just, you know, try to overpay for guys on one-year deals. Maintain flexibility, and that'll enable them to try to compete a little bit this year. They're going to have $28 million in space if they keep Calderon, who's making a little over $7 million this year. They could stretch him over 3 years. That would get enough to $33 million, but they would have to pay, you know, about a little over $2 million the next 2 years as well. Or if they're able to trade him for nothing, which you think is unrealistic, I think, you know, it's okay, could happen potentially, then they could get up to $35 million. But one thing you've noted is that, yeah, you probably couldn't do that at the outset of free agency with someone like Calderon. Maybe you could at the end, but by then your space isn't worth as much anyway.
And they don't really have the assets or the justification to do that, you know, unless Kevin Durant says he wants to go there. There is not a reason strong enough to clear that space right now. It's also why I'm vehemently against using the stretch provision on him, unless you had the right person. Yeah. And of course, that is the grand exception to all of these pronouncements, is that if that happened, but I just don't think it
would. Yeah, this is kind of how I was thinking about Calderon. We started talking about this before the show, and I was like, all right, let's just wait better if we talk about it during the show. Is, let's say he could still be, you know, he's probably an average backup point guard at the point, right? He can shoot the ball, make good passes, terrible on defense, but, you know, there's not too many two-way backup point guards out there. They're going to need another backup point guard. They only have Jerry and Grant. Signing a point guard in free agency is going to be tough. There aren't that many on the market. So if you get rid of his $7 million, then you got to pay at least $3 to $5 million for an equivalent backup point guard as him anyway. Why not just keep him on, bite the bullet, the fact that he's going to be overpaid by maybe $3 million, $4 million this year, and then just get the obligation done with. That's kind of how I would look at it. Again, unless there's just some amazing opportunity that comes by.
I actually agree with you pretty completely, because he also doesn't translate into any future obligations. So whether it's a disappointment or not, it's a year that their expectations are not as high as they should be in the future. So you even if you are sacrificing a little bit, who cares? You're getting out of it clean. You have a guy who can play capably, who can shepherd a second unit that does not have, depending on who they have, probably doesn't have a ton of shot creation on it. So you can just have him run some pick and rolls, depending on what you want to do with Porzingis. Could even see how he works as a pick and pop five if they still want to start Robin Lopez, and get some more information on what you have in KP. And I like him in that role. And as you said, the point guard market, when we did that preview, you know, it's slim pickings out there, and those players in particular are going to have the leverage to ask for years. And I think years could be more important than annual value for some of those guys when the market is this bonkers. You'd rather lock in, and even if it's a little bit lower, you'd rather lock in that for 3 or 4 years if you can, because Ramon Sessions isn't going to be getting that in a couple years. So when you're the Knicks, it's a lot harder to make that pitch, even if you have a lot of playing time. And giving somebody 2 years again, like, I was very critical of the player options they gave to Aflalo and Derek Williams. Doing that again is more precarious, because 2017 matters more to them than 2016 in terms of usable space.
So let's assume that Aflalo, who didn't even start down the end, seems to think he's still a starter. He's probably gone. Derek Williams, you imagine he's probably gone too. I don't know how much he really helps them. He's pretty redundant with Carmelo. They can't really play with him at the same time. So the two interesting situations for them are Lance Thomas, who played very well last year, but then had a knee injury and hasn't played as well. We talked about him in the Wings podcast a little bit. They have early bird rights on him, which, as a refresher, he's been on the team for 2 years. So he has a very small cap hold, a little over $2 million, which is nice. So I'm including that in that $28 million in space they have. And so they can use up all that space and then re-sign him, as long as his new contract starts at the estimated average player salary, which should be just over $6 million or so. It is possible that Thomas could get a bigger offer than that, especially if it's short term. So that'll be interesting to see whether they could fit him into that. I think they should try to bring him back, though. He was a valuable player. You know, something like a 2 year, $12 million deal starting at that, what they can pay him with the bird exception. That would be, I think, ideal. That might be a pretty good deal for Thomas, but I could see him maybe getting that. It's possible.
it's his skills will be in demand in that market, but it will depend to a degree on what he wants. Like I think he could possibly get more money, but he will have playing time, and if he is interested in either getting out in the market again or just having that kind of an opportunity, there might not be that many places that will give him what the Knicks can, especially when you consider that other than Melo, they just don't have a lot of forwards if you consider Porzingis a center.
Langston Galloway is in a somewhat similar boat, other than the fact that he is a restricted free agent. Thomas is unrestricted. He, as a second-year player, falls under the Gilbert Arenas provision. We talked about that when we discussed Jordan Clarkson in the point guards preview. So if you want a deep primer on that, go back and listen there. But basically, any team giving him an offer, the first 2 years are based on the MLE, and then you get a 4.5% raise in the second year over the MLE, and then you can pay him up to the max in the third and fourth year. That probably won't be an issue for Galloway. And again, the Knicks, if they're just giving him a contract on their own, they would be utilizing that early bird exception. I think Galloway, it's dubious whether he would fall into that kind of $6 million a year category in this market, especially when there aren't very many point guards. If they could get him to sign for 3 years and a little over $18 million starting at the Larry Bird. Again, remember the early bird exception. Remember, they want to hold on to his cap hold and not have to pay him more than what they're allowed to based on his cap hold. They could pay him more than the early bird, but then they have to eat into that $28 million in space. That's why it's important that he falls into that category. What do you think? You think it's realistic that they could fit him into the early bird exception like Thomas, potentially?
I think it's possible. While the free agent guard market is thin, I don't see Galloway, from my experience with him, as somebody who a team's going to fall in love with and say, hey, we have to do that. And the Knicks aren't prominent enough where a team would be thinking that they need to screw them and make a challenging offer just to, you know, tie up their books. It's certainly possible, but I don't think it's likely. So that range seems fair to me.
Well, and the beauty of it is, too, is that whatever offer comes in, they can match it with the early bird exception. So that will be helpful for them, because that first year salary of any new contract would fall within the exception. So they'll be okay with that. They can kind of leverage that out in restricted free agency, hold on to that $2.7 million cap hold. What do you think these guys need as a team?
They need more talent. I mean, I think that ideally shot creation from another guard would be great. Athleticism on the wing would be a huge addition for them. And just figuring out what members of that front court they want to stick long term, and then figuring out around that, because Robin Lopez, clearly a good player. Porzingis, good player. I really like Kyle O'Quinn. I've been on board with him for a long time. But what you want around any combination of, let's say, two of those three is substantially different than if you're keeping all three of them together.
They're going to need a starting two. They probably need a starting level one. I mean, if you're really talking about this team being any good next year, Aflalo is leaving. He wasn't that great anyway. They got Calderon, who is too old and slow. Jerry and Grant is athletic, but didn't show the ability to shoot the ball at all. And he'll probably look better if Jeff Hornacek's going to play up-tempo, run some more pick and rolls, but we have no idea if he's ready to be a starting level point guard. The odds are probably no. So in this market, coming up with a starter at the one and the two with $28 to $35 million, going to be pretty tough. You know, I think they're going to be kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel, hoping that they can come up with something. But, you know, for them to really significantly improve over last year, it's going to be kind of difficult, I think.
And the Knicks did a really good job, you mentioned it earlier, of building their talent level last offseason. They signed reasonable contracts. I thought they did a nice job. But they're still a long way away because they started with such a bare cupboard. And I think it's unrealistic to really push them into that playoff role for another season. But if they can show flashes, I think that's enough for the future. And I believe they have their own draft pick in 2017. So I think that would be a success for me, but I'm not their owner.
Well, so there's a couple of ways that they can go with getting a guy at the tour. You could try to get in on the Derby for guys like Batum, Parsons, really where you're just going to have to max these guys out. You know, even Harrison Barnes, they probably don't need because he's more of a combo forward. They need someone who can do something with the ball in their hands like Batum or Parsons. They could do that. That's obviously going to have to be 4 years. It could be an okay contract, but you're eating into 2017 space, and their 2017 situation is They are slated to have about $51 million in space, less any contracts they sign this year that bleed into that. So you want to reduce your 2017 space by $25 million, or you could maybe go for someone kind of short-term along the lines of Eric Gordon. I think they really need more shooting. He can handle and pick and roll a little bit. Giving him, you know, a one-year, $18 million kind of make-good deal, maybe you could go in that direction with him. Kent Bazemore, another guy they might look at as someone who isn't necessarily going to handle and pick and roll, but at least can drive a closeout, can defend one-twos. But, you know, once again, pretty slim pickings. I mean, I guess you could also try to just, you could offer something to DeMar DeRozan. That would have to be a max contract, but he is, this is no good that we actually are doing this when I can see you, because Danny just put his, like, forehead in his hands. Hey, he's had two good games in a row in the playoffs, but yeah, he and Carmelo together, not quite the optimal offense.
They'll do that on the Lakers ball. Instead.
Yeah.
But
so, all right, I've talked for too long here. Who do you like for these guys?
It's kind of cheating, but I think that the best tact for them is just to see who gets underserved by the market. Eric Gordon, if you could get him on a one-year deal, yeah, I could see that as a justifiable thing. Solomon Hill is intriguing just as a, you know.
They could try to get into the restricted market on Evan Fournier. I think he could be an okay fit there.
But do you think he's going to be a value contract? I mean, because Evan Fournier is going to be a
four. Well, nobody's going to be a value contract this year. It's all relative.
Well, exactly. That's why you wait. Unless you can get somebody who is close enough to a value contract, we can throw back to the Nene test, where if you got the right person in 2017, that you could move them into space, because a lot of teams will have space then too.
Well, I like going for a restricted free agent, because that's more on the timeline with Porzingis. And you know, I said that it would be hard for them to improve. Obviously, one way is that he'd be better next year and also will be used better by Hornacek, where they actually run a pick and pop. Alan Crabb is another guy that they could look at, where he, you know, it would be someone who can shoot the ball. Again, not going to play off the dribble, but maybe he grows into that and he becomes your starting two. If not, you know, he could play some two and three. They desperately need some more shooting on this team, to be sure. You know, Courtney Lee is sort of a short-term stopgap classic two guard, another guy that they could, you know, consider paying a short-term deal to, you know, in the mid eight figures, $15 million or so, just put, you know, overpay for it to be short. Not a lot of great options though here, judging by your facial expression.
It would be fun to see local product, or at least in my head he's a local product, Maurice Harkless, just to give him an offer, a talented guy. If they are thinking Melo is going to be around long-term, he could be a decent fit to bridge those gaps, but I don't think most of those players are going to be worth it for them with their aspirations in the future. But, you know, I think that the Knicks, I've been critical of their direction for a long time because I have, as we talked about, these lofty aspirations for what they can do with their space, and they haven't done it. You can't really prove the counterfactual in this kind of a case, but if they can really make it work, I think Porzingis is the foundation of something that could be legitimately dangerous in 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, but to me, there's no one on this market. I'm sure they'll do their diligence on KD and even LeBron James, but those guys, you'd have to imagine no thought of them coming here in the media. So aside from that, this is a young team. You're not about to compete right now. Try to get some quick veteran. Like, my plan one would be go after some restricted free agent who could grow with Porzingis. If that fails, hit the bargain basement, overpay for guys like Eric Gordon, or maybe even you could offer Jamal Crawford a little bit as a guy to give you some offense off the bench. OJ Mayo, maybe he could be like this year's Aflalo. Lance Stevenson, another guy who could maybe create off the dribble that bring him home to New York. These are not great options, but that's why you're not going to pay him for more than 1 year. And these options are so bad that you're not going to change your team's fortune here. So keep the powder dry. Try to chase the 8 seed again, placate Carmelo, and then maybe look to move him at the trade deadline if, you know, it's looking like you're, again, not where you really want to be as a franchise, and maybe he will finally come around to the idea that if he wants to compete, he's going to have to be traded, because it's just not realistic to get rich quick.
Agreed.
All right, how about the Clippers now? They are looking at free agencies of Jeff Green, Jamal Crawford, and Austin Rivers among guys that they probably would look at as their rotation players. They also have Cole Aldrich, but because they're going to be close to the cap, they are not going to be able to bring him back, most likely. The most that they will be able to pay him is either the mid-level exception. That probably won't get it done because he was just on a minimum contract last year, so they don't have any kind of bird rights on him at all. Let's start with, if they don't re-sign Green, Crawford, or Austin Rivers, they will have approximately $10.5 million in space, with their 2016 first-round draft pick, Chris Paul, DeAndre Jordan, Blake Griffin, the big three, J.J. Redick, Paul Pierce, and C.J. Wilcox under contract. So it probably makes more sense for them to just stay over the cap and try to re-sign those guys, right?
Yeah, and that's even more true this year when $10 million isn't going to get you much. I think it would have been true last year as well, but it'll be even more noticeable in 2016.
And the problem, though, of course, is to re-sign those guys, you have to leave their cap holds on the books until you re-sign them. And Jeff Green, his cap hold is almost $14 million. Jamal Crawford, his cap hold, $10.7 million. And then Austin Rivers, his cap hold is $5.9 million. So when you look at all that, they are going to be well over the cap and actually pretty darn close to being over the tax. In fact, they will be over the tax with those combined cap holds that add up to almost $30 million. The question is, what can they actually re-sign those guys for, especially because those guys know that they have them over a barrel, just like with Cleveland last year for some of their guys like Shumpert or Tristan Thompson, that they can't replace these guys with cap space. All they'll have is the mid-level exception starting at $5.6 million.
And what makes these guys more, even more dangerous than Shumpert and Tristan is that they're unrestricted free agents. So they have even more leverage because they can just leave if they want to. There isn't any sort of an issue related to match rights or anything like that. And the other significant factor to consider here is the looming specter of the hard cap, because if they get all the way up there, then the Clippers have to deal with the mini mid-level as opposed to the full mid-level, which I'm sure they would love to use if it was available.
Yeah, and don't forget, the way the hard cap works, Clippers fans will remember this from 2 years ago, if you use your full mid-level, then you are hard capped at the apron. There, under no circumstances would they be allowed to exceed approximately $115 million in salary for next year. And so they will have above, I guess the better way to put it is, below the tax, they will have approximately $30 million with which to work to re-sign Green, Crawford, and Rivers. And if they want to use their mid-level, you really probably want to be, even if you're using the full mid-level of $5.6 million, when you use it, you probably want to start off $10 million below the apron so that you still have $4 million bucks or so in wiggle room. And they can open up a little bit more. They can maybe stretch Paul Pierce, especially if he wants to retire. That he's due to make $3.5 million this next year and then has another million guaranteed the year after. So if they stretch him over 5 years, that would reduce his hit down to a little bit less than a million. So you open up another $2.5 million there. They could dump C.J. Wilcox, who I think actually still has some modicum of potential, get rid of another $1.2 million with him. They could trade their first-round pick that has a cap hold of a little over $1 million. So they could open up slightly more space in terms of wiggle room, but those are actually cheap contracts, at least Wilcox and the draft pick, that you don't necessarily want to just mortgage to open up a little more maneuvering room under the apron. So let me ask you this, Danny. If they have, we'll call it $25 million to work with to re-sign those guys and still use the MLE, which could hopefully bring them in another backup center to replace Aldridge, who they're almost certain to lose, is that enough to re-sign those three guys?
I don't think so. I'm not completely sure. I think it'll be just enough to bring back Green and Rivers, depending on how much leverage they choose to exert.
What do you think Green gets?
I'd say an annual value between $13 and $15 million seems about not fair, because it's not what I'd pay him, but what I'd expect.
That seems really steep to me, considering that he is 29, and I think of an average starter as making $15 million. Now, he was already making, I forget, you know, 8 or 9, and clearly the Clippers traded a first round pick for him because of the fact that they could re-sign him with bird rights. So Green and his agent know this, and they, like I said, could have the Clippers over a barrel where you're already kind of pot committed. You traded away this asset to get this guy. You have no way to replace him. Maybe it will end up being that bad, which would be a problem, certainly. Maybe you could see Rivers instead just going more years, especially because he has not exactly been Mr. Future when it's come to the Clippers, and people are always speculating that he's not going to stick around after this kind of Paul Jordan Griffin era ends, which could happen as early as the end of next year with both Paul and Griffin able to be free agents. So maybe that's what happened. He just gives all these guys more years, lower starting salary this year. I could see them kind of mortgaging the future a little bit in that way, even more so than they already have. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to pay Jeff Green more than $8 million a year. And that, even that is probably generous. You know, he's there's not much evidence that he is much more than sort of an end of the back of the rotation guy. And that's, you know, a $6 million a year player in this market probably. But he's going to get more than that, you would have to imagine, just due to the story of how he got on the team.
I also don't love Jeff Green as a potential free agent buy because he doesn't bring anything specifically positive to the table. He's not a good enough defender to say, oh, well, you can have him do that. He doesn't create significant offense for himself or others. He doesn't drill open shots. He's not a bad player. He just doesn't have that real hook, at least to me.
What about Crawford? Age 36, cap hold $10.7 million, but you know, could start off at less or more than that. They can pay him up to the max if they wanted to. What do you think he ends up getting? He has switched agents recently because he was under that under-market contract for 4 years. There was talk that he wanted an extension, which he wasn't eligible for. He seems to be a little bit aggrieved that he hasn't been paid that well. I imagine he's going to be trying to extract everything that he can out of him. And once again, they probably still need him, although with his age, he could fall off a cliff at any time, and he almost kind of did this last year during the regular season. For most of the year, the six-man award was undeserved, as we've talked about many times. But where do you see him?
With a lot of guys, it really depends on what he wants, but the Clippers are a nice confluence because they are a good team. They're a competitive team that has a role for him, and they should be able to offer him plenty of money with full bird rights. So I think that he'll try to leverage them maybe more in terms of years than dollars, because when you hit 36, those years really do matter, and you're getting money that you probably wouldn't get otherwise. But and also, I think that is a more reasonable compromise for the constraints that the Clippers have, would be to go in that direction. I'm not saying I would agree with it. It just is a logical endpoint.
I could see them giving him 3 years, because another thing that Rock Divers probably doesn't really understand that well as a coach is like what a normal aging curve is. And Crawford, let's not forget, to his credit, he's done an amazing job of staving off aging, but Paul Pierce had done that too up until this year, and then he fell off a cliff. So I could see this is terrifying, but I could see him getting, like, you know, 3 years, $24 million or something like that, and the last 2 years of that contract could just be so bad. And then Austin Rivers, gosh, like, you know, I mean, when you want to talk about what Crawford is worth, you know, 1 year, $6 million, 1 year, $7 million, something like that, I think would be, you know, maybe give him a partial non-guarantee on a second year for about that range would be fair. And then for Austin Rivers, I would say, you know, 3 years, $18 million, something like that would be about where he would be. But again, they have full bird rights on him. He's the coach's son. So I don't know. I mean, do you want to just guess at what he's going to get? I perish at the thought, really.
I've said before that I think it's a legitimate possibility that he gets $10 million. I don't expect it. I think
how many years?
Three, maybe? So like 330, but I think it's going to be more in the 324 range. It's a truly unique negotiation, though, because the Clippers have this issue of the combined money for all these players, and you can make an argument that, you know, that Austin would be the most logical player to sacrifice to keep the team together, especially considering he's negotiating against his dad. Yeah. But at the same point, he has a ton of leverage because he fills a role with them, and he's one of the only actual young people on this team.
Yeah, we looked at the very thin point guard market and concluded, at least I did, that he's kind of towards the top of those backup point guards, in part because he's so young and can improve and at least has some athleticism. And he has gotten better when he's been there. But I still think what's going to happen, the more I think about it, because they're going to want to use the full mid-level, is that they are just going to pay these guys smaller starting salaries and then just stretch out the years, probably. With Rivers, that's maybe not the end of the world. That with Crawford and Green, it probably is. But, you know, Rock Divers may not be around to really have to pay the piper on those contracts. Divers did say that he is not going to be trading away any of the big three after what happened. I see no reason not to take him at his word, but, and again, this is not a forward-looking organization. I don't think that they are thinking about, oh, we better trade these guys because we could lose them for nothing. Maybe if they are just, you know, in the sixth seed or something, and everyone's been healthy as of the trade deadline, they would revisit that. But I don't think that they will.
I don't think they will. I mean, I advocated, I wrote that piece for the Sport News about how I personally feel that they should have traded Chris Paul during this season for the end game reasons, and he's done well. And the Clippers are in this weird spot because if they keep all those players, Paul, Griffin, even if they come back, then you're getting into another scary, dangerous spot because as great as Chris Paul has been, of course, then you'll be paying him in his mid-30s if you decide to bring him back. And Blake Griffin has been disappointing, I guess would be a fair word for it so far, and he is popular enough, intelligent enough to expect a full max contract, which is going to be extremely lucrative for him. So bringing those guys back, especially in a year when they have potential for serious cap space, is another challenge that they're going to have to deal with and should be considering right now, because the money that they spend on players running into next year, while free agency is probably not the most likely way to improve, it does curtail their options at that point.
The other interesting thing is looking ahead to 2017. And a lot of teams, again, with the cap going up, like the Warriors, for example, are going to have space that year. With Griffin and Paul, however, both of them are going to have cap holds over $30 million. So just with the, and then J.J. Redick will be a free agent too. His cap hold will be $11 million. So you combine those guys and DeAndre Jordan, and you're basically right at the projected $107 million cap already. So if you want to re-sign those guys, then you're not really going to be able to add to the team again, assuming that both Paul and Griffin would get maxed out once again. So I do think that unless they just have an unbelievable season next year and really feel like they're just so close and we bring all these guys back, that there will be significant changes next summer. And if they were to move on from Griffin or from Paul, there are plenty of other free agents they could get with that $30 million salary slot. And now they would also struggle with depth. Redick is someone that they could bring back, you know, on a shorter-term deal, overpay him. His cap hold won't be that big. He'll probably make more than that next year if he can repeat this year. So he's someone that they could bring back. But I could see them just, like, re-signing Paul, letting Griffin go, and then trying to get one of the other 2017 free agents. But that's probably getting a little bit too far ahead of ourselves for this particular exercise. The last thing before we go on them, their draft picks 2017 and 2019 are already traded, lotto protected. And what about any rookie extensions upcoming? That's like part of this rubric that I created. Anything there?
Oh, yeah. They have so much young talent on this team they're going to have to consider. And Rivers has even talked about the idea of basically trading their pick because they don't do well with their picks anyway, which is scary when you think about a GM and you think about how, especially for big market teams, those kind of cheap contracts can be the backbone, the cornerstone of that makes all the rest of their financial reality possible. And the Clippers have just missed on those guys.
Who do you think? So they're going to need more wings still, of course. You know, they'll probably can get some relatively close to the minimum guys, but even those guys are going to have chances to get $2-3 million a year. The Wes Johnson types, the Mbah Mute types that they got this year, there's going to be so much more space out there. They might not be able to necessarily get them. But let's say they're able to fill in Green, Crawford, and Rivers and still have room for the full MLE. Anybody that you think they could get as a backup big to replace Aldridge or as a wing guy that could fall into that price range?
Roy Hibbert presumably has a house in the relative area, considering his illustrious year with the Lakers. But big men are going to be in short supply, and Cole Aldrich was a great signing for them. I don't think they'll be able to bring him back for the mid-level, so you're going to be looking at somebody who has significant flaws.
I could see them, Brandon Bass, who's already in L.A., someone that Doc Rivers has coached before, being someone that they might look at. Maybe the full MLE is a little bit too much for him at this point in his career at age 31. Maybe Zaza Pachulia might be a little bit too expensive as a backup center, and also they just don't need that many minutes out of a pure backup center. I mean, if I'm the Clippers, I want to get someone who can swing between the four and the five. Nene, probably a little bit too expensive there as well, but again, if they go out with big years, then maybe they could get someone like that as well. Darrell Arthur, someone who I think maybe they could consider.
Jason Smith?
Yeah, that wouldn't be terrible. I mean, it would be nice to have someone who could play some defense on that second unit. But, Mo Spates could be another guy, too, has actually played against Rivers in the playoffs, right? Like, maybe like him at the full MLE wouldn't be terrible and, provide some shooting on the second unit. That's who I'd look at. And then on the wing, Solomon Hill would be awesome on this team, actually. And actually, we forgot to talk about him. I guess I must have accidentally just deleted him when I was moving guys around to rank them on my spreadsheet. But he's a combo forward. I would have had him at kind of the top of those rotation guys. I actually would pay Solomon Hill more than that much to start, frankly. But maybe he'll be undervalued by the market, and that's someone that they could get in on. Could bring back old friend Matt Barnes as well, age 36. That's a thought, too. So they'll have some options with guys who I think can help them, but it all starts with getting those guys under contract so you can use the full MLE and also the BAM even as well for $2 million, although that's a less powerful tool than in years past. Otherwise, they're stuck with that $3.5 million taxpayer mid-level exception, and that does not have the hard cap the way the BAE or the MLE do.
Another fringy wing guy that they could consider is former Doc Rivers, not protege, but player Gerald Green. I think that would be a possibility as well.
All right, that'll do it for today's program. Thanks so much for listening. You got anything to plug before we go?
Yeah, so I wrote two pieces on Game 3 of the Warriors-Thunder series for The Athletic. I also have the Boston Celtics offseason preview will be going up on the Sporting News on Tuesday morning. And for those of you who didn't read it, I wrote a little piece for the Sporting News on why Stephen Curry will not get a raise this year and why a renegotiation and extension is impractical for him.
Yeah, that was something that was brought up on Bill Simmons' podcast, I think last Friday. But yeah, you did a great job of breaking down why it is that wouldn't quite make sense, both for him financially and also for the Warriors. It's just better for them both to wait until 2017 for that. I did that podcast with Anthony Slater, the Oklahoman, a good one on Game 3, and also we looked at the Thunder going forward, what this team might do in the future. A lot of that obviously depends on what happens in these next couple of weeks. And then I was also on True Hoop TV with a cast of people a lot more famous than I am. So follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. We will, of course, be at and live tweeting that game tomorrow, the Game 4 of the century in a lot of ways. A lot riding on this game, for sure. One of the bigger NBA games in a long time. Really going to be happy to be there. The crowd is going to be going nuts after what happened with Draymond. No pun intended. Seriously, I actually meant that. Most people, when they say no pun intended, they actually did mean it. I did not mean it right there. But this is really starting to evolve, so we'll end it right here. We'll talk to you all tomorrow night. Till then.